Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, the Save Redland Library campaign looks at dissident writers. This week, Jack Windle from Bristol Acorn, a trade union helping people who are tenants. He chose a book called The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist to review by Robert Tressel, written in 1911, and also a poem by Tony Harrison on not being Milton. We also hear from Manfred Petrisch from Abkhazia on the east coast of the Black Sea, talking about the Easter terrorist attacks and much, much more. His website is the Smoke and Mirrors blog. He writes in German, but if you get one of these clever internet systems, you can translate it into English. But anyway, he speaks in English here exclusively for us. And also Justin Walker from the West Country's British Constitution Group. The United States of Europe, he says, will not allow Brexit to take place. We're not in a democracy, we're living in something called an oligarchy. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
Firstly, thanks for the invitation, although I wasn't actually invited. That went to national organiser Nick, so sorry, you've got to make do with me. Nick was one of the founder members of our union Acorn. We started 5 years ago in Bristol when him and a few friends started door knocking in Easton because they were sick of austerity and they wanted new and more effective ways of fighting back. In that time, we've grown into a national union. We have branches up and down the country. We have thousands of members and we're taking on and winning campaigns against banks, councils, etc. Universal credit is obviously sort of one of the front lines against austerity. And we've got commitments from housing associations with tens of thousands of tenants in Bristol not to evict anyone due to late payment because of universal credit. We've also successfully resisted evictions by the council of their own tenants because of the same reason. So do join Acorn. Come and talk to me afterwards if you'd like to join. I'm here to talk about Robert Tressel's The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, which I'm sure is familiar to many of you. The reason that it's a fitting book to talk about in the context of Acorn is that what motivated those founding members 5 years ago, and certainly what motivates me, is what the dearly departed Tony Benn referred to as the flame of struggle and the flame of hope that is in the heart of the struggle. And this book really has done more than any other over the last century to keep that flame alive and to pass it on from generation to generation. It was the book that made my great-grandmother a socialist and in turn made my great-grandfather a socialist, and it's kind of come down to me through my family. What I propose to do really is not talk that much about the contents of the book, but rather to talk about the story of its production and its publication. The conceit of the novel is that it's the kind of entire lifespan of a working-class person in the building trades in a small southern town like Hastings, spread out over a year. And the way that he captures that is by going from an apprentice, Bert, who's 15 years old, right up to the oldest character, Philpot, who is ancient by the dint of being in his 60s, which in the building trades in the 1900s was very old. The central character is a guy called Frank Owen, Frank being honest, Owen being a nod to Robert Owen, the kind of founder of the cooperative movement. So he wrote this book between 1906 and 1909. He couldn't find a publisher. He was sick of living in extreme poverty with his daughter. He left Kathleen in Hastings and he went off to Liverpool to try and secure passage to Canada to start a new life. When he got to Liverpool, his illness caught up with him. He was taken very seriously ill. And Kathleen received a telegram saying, "Your father died last night." She didn't have any money. She couldn't go. She couldn't make any arrangements to deal with funeral arrangements and what have you. So he was buried in an unmarked grave in Walton, I believe it was, in Liverpool in 1910-11. Kathleen had to go into domestic service, which is what you did if you were a poor young woman at the time and you had no connections. She went in service for a wealthy family in London who were friends with a woman called Jessie Pope. Anyone familiar with Jessie Pope? She was kind of a writer of really weird jingoistic poetry urging young men to go and get killed in the First World War. That's what she's most famous for. Kathleen said to her, do you think that you could get this book published? So Jesse Pope went to her publisher, showed him the book. He was amazed by it, as she was. And the publisher agreed to pay her £25 to give to Kathleen for the manuscript and to pay her another £25 to edit the book for publication. So it was published in 1914 in a very heavily redacted form that kind of travestied the ending of the book. It hollowed out a lot of the political content. There's debate ongoing about whether or not that was kind of deliberately ideological on Jesse Pope's part, or whether it was just that an upper middle class educated woman editing this book down chopped out a lot of the politics because she thought she was just making it a better story. Anyhow, in that heavily redacted form, it still became a classic. And in the 1930s, it was a very powerful influence over the proletarian writers of that period. Walter Greenwood's Love on the Dole, for example, has a big debt to the Ragged Child of Philanthropists. It's just kind of transposed to a northern industrial setting in Salford. And it went on to have an even bigger effect during the war when there was a paper shortage, so there were services editions of a lot of books. And it was read by thousands and thousands of servicemen, including Alan Sillitoe, who was obviously a very famous novelist when the 50s and 60s came around, who was not alone in crediting the book with winning the election for Labour in 1945, which is, I mean, even if it stretches belief a little bit, it's a very, very remarkable thing for a novel to be accused of winning an election for the Labour Party. You know, anyone who thinks that that wasn't a great government, you maybe need to be in the Books and Conservatism event that's taking place in a nearby library somewhere else. But it's a momentous thing. 10 years after that election victory, nice one, Robert Tressel, a painter-decorator from Hastings called Fred Ball had heard a lot about this book. He'd read it in its heavily redacted form. And he was obsessed with tracing the manuscript and publishing it in its full form, which he managed to do, and he handed over 63 one-pound notes in a cafe in Paddington Station to someone whose name no one's ever been able to trace. And he took possession of this metal box with the manuscript in it. He and his wife, at their kitchen table in Hastings, then spent months and months piecing together the novel as it was originally intended to be published, which was a real labour of love. They steamed apart pages that Jesse Pope had stuck together. They read pages from the back of the page of passages that had been scored out using a mirror. And eventually they were able to piece together the book as it was meant to be published. It came out in 1955 or 6, I can't quite remember, and had a second life, as it were, as this full novel, where it had an even more momentous effect. It's been translated into, I think, 24 languages. It's kind of still notching up new languages every few years, and is credited by many, many, many people with changing their lives completely. This is an edition from 2006, and in the introduction there's a wonderful passage about internet message boards about the book, and there's someone in who recently, when this was written in 2006, posted on this message board saying that it was remarkable that this book, published in England in 1914, could so accurately capture life in Manila in the Philippines in 2004. And it's really remarkable that the book has that lasting power and it speaks to such universal themes. There's a little bit in here, I'm just going to read a tiny bit, that I think you'll see what I mean by it speaking across generations. So much of the political content happens by dint of, like, tea break conversations, lunch break conversations, in a building called The Cave that Franco and the central character and his workmates are working on. They're discussing fiscal policy, free trade versus protectionism with Europe at the time. None of them really understood the subject. Not one of them had ever devoted 15 consecutive minutes to the earnest investigation of it. The papers they read were filled with vague and alarming accounts of the quantities of foreign merchandise imported into this country, the enormous number of aliens constantly arriving, and their destitute conditions, how they lived, the crimes they committed, and the injury they did to British trades. These were the seeds which, cunningly sown in their minds, caused to grow up within them a bitter, undiscriminating hatred of foreigners. Basically, it's the sun, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's not a million miles from where we are today. And a characteristic response from Owen is, and this is kind of the tone of the book and what makes it so, like, empowering and energizing and angry-making. Some of you seem to think that it was a great mistake on God's part to make so many foreigners. You ought to hold a mass meeting about it. Pass a resolution, something like this. This meeting of British Christians hereby indignantly protests at the action of the Supreme Being in having created so many foreigners and calls upon him to forthwith rain down fire, brimstone and mighty rocks upon the heads of all those Philistines so that they may be utterly exterminated from the face of the earth, which rightly belongs to the British people. Chaucer was an Irishman. He'd spent time in South Africa. That is coming from someone who understands British colonialism from being on the receiving end of it. And it's a very, very powerful indictment, really, of what was going on at the time. Now, one of the reasons that, in fact, just a side note, having said that this is passed down from generation to generation, because of its second success and its second life form from the 1950s, there's grown up this kind of big culture around Tressel. He's a unique cult figure, really, on the left. And my great-granny, who was kind of converted by the book in the 1910s, 20s, went to Walton in Liverpool in the 1970s for the dedication of that pauper's grave, because a local historian in Liverpool was so bothered, he bothered to find out where Tressel was buried, and he was buried in this pauper's grave with tens of other people who had an unmarked grave. But finally, he got the kind of monument that he deserved, which I think is really powerful. How long have I got left? Because I could carry on.
3 minutes.
3 minutes. Okay, cool. So in its second life, it's been an extremely powerful influence on a lot of people. Ricky Tomlinson was given the book by the governor of his prison when he was in solitary confinement for spurious political charges in the 70s. But its political effect has almost done Tressel a kind of disservice in the long run. I have a PhD in English literature, and you don't really encounter this book on English courses in British universities, or extremely seldom. You don't read it in schools. Part of that is deliberately ideological, right? Like, the state isn't going to teach us how to give a toss about our surroundings and change them. It's going to teach us the history of kings and queens and industrialists and politicians and what have you. But part of that is because this is categorised, it's pigeonholed as a political book. Whereas actually, it's as well as that, it's not that it's not that, it certainly is that. As well as that, it's a real masterpiece of 20th century literature. The book is constructed using the kind of sign writer's gaze that was Robert Tressel's day-to-day expertise. There's ways in which he's kind of using elements of visual culture from the visual arts at the time, to do with cubism, for example, to construct his narrative. He wants to flatten out the kind of rich texture of everyday lived experience of these working class people and show us all sides of it at the same time. And he actually uses drawings in there quite a lot as well. There's a wonderful chapter called The Oblong that kind of shows you British class society in diagrammatical form very astutely. And this is also a kind of performative thing that is wonderful, which is that he manages to distill Marxist economics into a kind of lunchtime theatrical experience with 3 cubes of bread, some pocket knives that the men eat their lunches with, and a few bits of spare change to show how the capitalist class has rigged the system and hoodwinks workers at every opportunity. It's a really, really, really remarkable book, and please don't let its status as a socialist classic put you off or make you not approach it as something that is genuinely a wonderful work of literature. If I've still got 30 seconds, I'm going to read what to me is kind of the very powerful essence of the book, which is, this is still in the opening chapter, there's just gold from beginning to end, but this is him talking about poverty. He's asked to define it by his workmates, who are obviously reading The Sun or whatever it was at the time. And they kind of take the mick out of him because he's got these notions about what poverty means. He says, "If a man is only able to provide himself and his family with the bare necessaries of existence, that man's family is living in poverty. Since he cannot enjoy the advantages of civilization, he might just as well be a savage. Better, in fact, for a savage knows nothing of what he is deprived. What we call civilization, the accumulation of knowledge which has come down to us from our forefathers, is the fruit of thousands of years of human thought and toil. It's not the result of the labour of the ancestors of any separate class of people who exist today, and therefore it is by right the common heritage of all." And I think that that's the kind of crux of this book, and it's something that Extinction Rebellion is about in terms of the commons, in terms of nature, that Morag's been touching on already with universal credit and benefits. You know, these are people's rights by dint of people who've gone before us that have fought for them. So go and give it a read. I hope you enjoy it. Just want to say that I'm reassured to know that Robin Hood is in fact from Yorkshire, because there's a proud Sheffielder. I've been telling people that my whole life.
Absolutely.
And that he didn't give his money away, because people say, Sheffielders say, if Sheffielders, that they throw their money around like a Scotsman with no arms. Which is brilliant. It's such a Sheffield thing to say, because it's like at once a little bit of holding a racist stereotype, but also in a self-deprecating way that makes it fine. So my wild card is basically anything by Tony Harrison. I would have brought his collected poems, but it's really quite heavy. He's in my view the best poet still writing in the English language. I saw him read some of his poems a couple of years ago, which was an immense privilege. Everyone should definitely read V, which is his like dramatic poem about the miners' strike that's staging a kind of internal conflict between his educated, acquired liberal identity and his working class roots. Absolutely fabulous poem about the miners' strike and a lot else besides. It's about Britain in the 80s. Still wonderful now. He also wrote a sonnet sequence called From the School of Eloquence, which is actually a quote from the last cover for the London Corresponding Society. Much of his poetry is really steeped in the British radical tradition. But he also spent time living in Africa, and for him there's very deep connections between the sort of radical working class movement in the UK and the abolitionist movement, which certainly in Sheffield history is a very prominent theme. And that's kind of written into a lot of these poems. So this is the very first poem from the School of Eloquence. They're 16-line sonnets. It is called On Not Being Milton, and it's dedicated to Sergio Vieira and Armando Guebuza, who were Frelimo freedom fighters in Mozambique. Red and committed to the flames, I call these 16 lines that go back to my roots, my Calle del Retorno Pe Natal, my growing black enough to fit my boots. The stutter of the scold out of the branks of condescension, class and counterclass thickens with glottals to a lumpen mass of ludding morphemes closing up their ranks. Each swung cast iron Enoch of lead stress clangs a forged music on the frames of art, the looms of owned language smashed apart. Three cheers for mute ingloriousness. Articulation is the tongue-tied fighting. In the silence round all poetry we quote Tid, the Cato Street conspirator who wrote, Sir, I am a very bad hand at writing. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And now to Manfred Petrisch. He was born in Argentina to German parents and worked for many years as a banker in Switzerland, now living on the east of the Black Sea in Abkhazia, which is just north of Georgia and south of Russia. I start by asking Manfred about something called Operation Gladio, that is to say terror cells, fascist terror cells, which operate behind enemy lines, which were started by the Nazis. The Nazis trained them up to cause trouble behind the lines as Europe was being liberated in 1945. The Nazis called them werewolves. When NATO started doing this, they changed the name to Gladio.
Well, they were designed to be so-called stay-behind cells, you know, stay-behind like the resistance in France during the German occupation to carry out because there was this fear that the Soviet Union would overrun Western Europe, and then they would have these stay-behind people who would then disrupt everything, just like the resistance did in France during the German occupation.
Carrying out sabotage, this sort of thing.
Right. But then, of course, it evolved these trained people and these weapons and everything that they had were then transferred into this new ideology of using terror to blame it on other people.
Well, the problem was, of course, the Soviet Union didn't invade and these fascist terror cells had nothing to do.
Exactly. So they had to find a new job for them. And this is what they did. And if a government did not follow the rules, then suddenly they had terror attacks in their country.
Now, let's just put the context here. For example, in Belgium, the Belgian government refused to have cruise missiles, didn't they? They said, well, this just makes us a target for a Soviet nuclear attack in the 1980s, in the Cold War. And they refused to have them. And all of a sudden, bombs started going off in Belgium and the government caved in and they said, OK, we'll have them because obviously we've got a problem with Soviet-sponsored terrorism. Actually, all the time, it was just fascist. But how do you link this to Christchurch? That sounds like a long distance in time and space.
Well, don't forget that New Zealand belongs to the Five Eyes. And if you know what I mean. And also, don't forget that the New Zealand government was opposed a lot of things that Israel wanted to do in the United Nations, and then Netanyahu came out with the threat that they will pay New Zealand back, and all these threats were happening.
Well, that's right. I mean, what they said was that the New Zealand government sponsored a motion at the United Nations, which was condemning the Israeli settlements in the occupied territories. So Netanyahu said that that was an act of war, and he said there will be retaliation.
Exactly, and don't forget that this alleged attacker in New Zealand also spent some time in Israel in 2016. So the Israeli government confirmed this, that he was there. So maybe he got also his anti-Palestinian ideology trained there, because everybody who goes to Israel is under a huge propaganda that the Palestinians are bad, that they are terrorists and so forth. And what happened in Christchurch is that Palestinian migrants who were there were the main victims of this attack. They were Palestinians. So there could be a connection there.
What would be the motive, though?
Well, this payback thing. And the other motive is, of course, that they want to disarm the New Zealanders. They want to get rid of all the weapons. I mean, this is a typical tactic to disarm the population using this kind of an attack, to get rid of all the weapons that the people have in their private possession.
The New Zealand government say that by making weapons less available, an attack like this is less likely to happen.
Well, that's nonsense, of course, because if I want to do a terror attack, do you think that laws will stop me? I will always get weapons, just like the attack in Paris. They had all the Kalashnikovs and all the weapons which they imported from the Balkans, and because there are no border checks anymore, they could just put them in their car and travel from Croatia or Serbia all the way up to Paris, and because of the no border control. So if you want to do a terror attack, you always get weapons, and the government can always supply you with weapons. That's not the problem.
So why do you think that the mosques were targeted, apart from, as you just said, that there were many Palestinian ex-refugees, migrants there?
Yeah. Well, you see, what is happening is you want to stir up trouble. You want to attack mosques and kill Muslims, and then on the other hand you will instigate also an attack on Christian churches and kill Christians, so that this whole thing, each group stirs up hate is stirred up, and then they fight each other and so forth. So that's the whole idea behind this. Also, the desecration and burning of churches in Europe, in France, in Germany. I mean, the media is not covering this, but there are more than 100 churches in the last 12 months were attacked in France.
Now, we've heard about the fire at Notre Dame, but we haven't really heard about the burning of Catholic churches in France and other sorts of attacks. So do you think that there's any chance that the attack on Notre Dame was deliberate? It wasn't just an accident. Macron has made it clear he believes right from the day after it happened that it was just an accident.
Well, according to my research, the person who was in charge of the security and alarm system, fire prevention in Notre Dame, said that, for instance, an accident caused by a short circuit in the cables, etc., is impossible because all the cables were renewed just a short time ago. And they were put in alarm sensors, fire sensors, etc. So it's impossible that this was caused, for instance, by a short circuit or something. And so forth. So it looks very much like this is a deliberate fire. And don't forget, you can cause a fire today without being there. You can just use a laser beam and point it at the tower, which was out of wood, and you can cause a fire with that, like using a piece of glass, and you use the sun to focus it onto a point and then onto wood, and then the wood starts burning. You can also do it with a laser beam, for instance, from 100 meters away. You don't have to actually go into the church to start the fire.
I mean, some French people have said that, well, it was Holy Week, and that was also significant. But what evidence have you got of other churches in France being attacked too? Because that certainly would make it more likely that the attack on Notre Dame was deliberate.
Well, I will tell you something. Exactly at the same time, and I mean up to the minute exactly the same time at 6:30, also the mosque in Jerusalem on the Temple Mount, a fire started. Did you know this? That a fire started at exactly the same time at the Temple Mount Mosque. The only difference is that there it was squashed and extinguished very quickly, so it didn't cause a big destruction. But the fire started exactly at the same time in Jerusalem as this fire started in Notre Dame.
Oh, now, Easter Sunday, we saw this horrific attack in Sri Lanka. Now, 320 people dead, something like 30 or 40 children. One does wonder what possible use it can be killing children. All that will do is cause people to despise and hate whoever's doing it. I mean, is there really any point for terrorists at killing children?
Of course not. You see, that's a very good point. Let's say if I were a real terrorist, then I would not attack metro systems and trains and airplanes where I always kill civilians, or I drive a truck into a Christmas market like in Berlin where I kill innocent people, or here sitting in a church. That already shows to me that this is not a real terror attack. It is just to cause hate. And because if I'm a real terrorist, I would attack those guys who actually caused the wars. I mean, the people on top, but not innocent people. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Of course. And the other thing is, you don't really need...
Isn't it interesting that nobody who caused the Iraq war, like Bush and Tony Blair, they never get attacked? Nobody attacks them, and all the other people who caused all the wars, or Hillary Clinton who caused the Libyan war, I mean, they're not being attacked. It's always innocent people being attacked.
Well, what about the idea of, you're someone who's been in the military, a suicide bomber. You don't really need to be a suicide bomber to attack a soft target like a church. I mean, there's very few people pointed this out, but it should be obvious that you don't need to be a suicide bomber to attack a soft target.
And what you do is you recruit a patsy, and what you do is you tell him, look, you go with this rucksack, you go over there and whatever, you play a role, and then you remote control and ignite this bomb without the guy actually doing it. He doesn't even know that he's carrying a bomb. He's just told to go from A to B and be there at a certain time, and then from remote control you ignite the bomb. I mean, this happens. There are many cases where this happens. I think this something similar happened at the London bombing.
Yeah, but I mean, do you have to be a suicide bomber to attack a soft target? I mean, even if you were consciously doing it, surely you could just put down a bag, walk around the corner, and detonate it.
Well, that proves my point. The people who have the bomb don't even know they're carrying a bomb. They walk into a place and then it's remote ignited through remote control, and then they say, "Well, it was a suicide bomber." But actually, he was not. He was just a patsy told to go somewhere.
Right? Do you see any connection between Christchurch and Sri Lanka? Because we've heard from Rita Katz and Site Intelligence and the AMAC news agency that this was some kind of ISIS operation, allegedly, and it possibly could have been in retribution for Christchurch.
Yeah, but who is ISIS? ISIS is an organization created by the intelligence services of America and Israel and British intelligence and whoever is behind them, and Saudi intelligence. I mean, ISIS are all mercenaries. They get paid, and they are organized by these intelligence services. So if they say ISIS is behind it, then they are behind it.
Do you think there's any connection, though, between Christchurch and Sri Lanka? In Christchurch, it was mosques which were attacked. In Sri Lanka, it was churches.
Yes, it's to create hate between the Christians and the Muslims. That's the whole point, that they get it at each other's throat. You see, by doing these things, you will then cause other conflicts that happen. You know, you create hate, and then this is like a snowball effect. It will get much bigger and bigger, because you start these attacks, one at the mosque and the other in the Christian church, and then this snowballs into a big thing, because that's what they want. They want the Christians and the Muslims to attack each other.
Why do you think it is that the Western media just repeats this whole thing of, well, ISIS have claimed this attack, where they don't really talk about who is behind ISIS? Why aren't we getting much analysis from the media?
Because they are controlled, and they are told to tell us only the narrative that they want us to believe. Isn't it interesting that ISIS never attacked Israel, although they are just next door? And not only that they didn't attack Israel, the Israeli military and government cooperated with ISIS and let the wounded ISIS terrorists into Israel to be in the hospital and get medical treatments. And this is all open. I mean, the Israeli government is saying that they did this, right? And also the White Helmets escaped via Israel. So they were the propaganda arm of the ISIS, right? Creating these so-called chemical attacks. I mean, that was all a big media stunt.
We've seen a big increase in tension between Iran and the US and Israel, with the United States, first of all, saying the Golan Heights belongs to Israel, not to Syria, which goes against the United Nations resolutions on the Golan Heights, and then also declaring the Iranian Revolutionary Guard a terrorist organization. Well, actually, it's just part of the government of Iran.
Trump is in the pocket of the Zionists in Israel. And actually, Netanyahu controls Trump, and Trump does everything that Netanyahu says he should do. So if Netanyahu says you have to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Trump does it. And when Netanyahu says you have to recognize the Golan Heights, then Trump does it.
What power does Netanyahu have over Trump, though? Surely Trump is his own man.
They must have something on him that they can put him under pressure. They must, after all, don't forget who controls New York and the financial system there. I mean, I worked in New York. I know who actually controls New York. And if Trump was a businessman there and he did all these constructions there, he had to arrange himself with the people who control New York. They must have something on him and can control him. After all, don't forget, the main job of all secret services, be it CIA, MI6, MI5, and also Mossad and BND, their main job is to get dirt on the politicians so that they can blackmail them. That's the main job.
So are you suggesting that New York is really just controlled by a kind of mafia oligarchy?
Absolutely, the financial system and the money people, right? And that's why also 9/11 happened and things like that. We all know, or people who can study a bit further than what the media says, knows what happened in New York at 9/11. I mean, who's behind it?
Tell us.
Well, it was an operation organized by also the secret services, mainly Saudi Arabia, the CIA, and the Mossad. These three organizations were behind 9/11, and they did this. I mean, this is what you call the deep state. Don't forget that all the secret services are a state in the state. And that's why President Kennedy wanted to destroy the CIA, and that was probably one of the main reasons why he got killed, that he saw that he could not, as a president, do things because there was this deep state blocking things and forcing him to do things that he didn't want.
But what would be the motive? What would be the motive, though, of 9/11 if it was done by the Mossad, the Saudis, and American intelligence?
To blame it on Arabs. I mean, they blamed it on the bad Arabs, and out of that, they were able to tell that Iraq was behind 9/11 and that they should attack Iraq and all the other things they did in the Near East. That was used as a pretense for all the following wars, and also to put in place the police state and the all the listening and spying and total control over all communications.
So what do you make of the Gilets Jaunes?
Well, the Gilets Jaunes is, as far as I can see, a true uprising by the French people, because there is no central control. It is totally decentralized. There is no figurehead. So it is not the usual uprising that we've seen in other places where there is a Soros behind it, or whoever else, or the American state foreign ministry, or somebody who finances the Yellow Vests in France is really a grassroots uprising. And the latest news is now that the number of police who have committed suicide has doubled since the beginning of year compared to the last year. So there is a big moral problem in the police forces, which on the one hand are being forced by the government to go against the French people, and then they are in a huge conflict. And this brings a lot of policemen to commit suicide because they cannot handle this conflict.
There's
what
also
they see as morally right and what the government is trying to do.
Well, there's also a lot of backlash against Merkel in Germany, against migrants there, this United States of Europe. Where do you think that one particular project is heading?
Well, it is heading into the direction that those countries who are actually the payers of the system want to get out, and then the EU will be left only with countries who are on the receiving end, like all the Eastern new EU members. if Britain goes out, there is one big contributor who is, will be gone. And who is going to take up the slack then? Is it going to be Germany or whoever? So that's a big problem, that the EU is actually falling apart because they think that with their central government, which you cannot elect in Brussels, you can dictate all the countries what to do and punish them if they don't do what they are told. And this is a rebellion against this central government thing in Italy and in all the countries who are suffering economically from the euro.
But you say it's not elected. We're just about to have a European elections.
Yes, but that's just a pseudo election. That means you have to know that the 751 members of the European Parliament are only figureheads. They have nothing to say. They cannot, for instance, initiate laws. I mean, what kind of a parliament is this if you can't initiate laws? The laws are made by the Commission and by the bureaucrats behind the Commission, and they bring in the laws, and they only have to inform the parliament about these things. The parliament itself cannot initiate any laws, so it's useless. It's a pseudo parliament, right? I mean, I've talked to parliamentarians and I asked them, what the hell are you guys doing? You can't do anything. You're just getting your 15,000 euros per month and all the other goodies that you get, but you can't do anything there. I mean, you just sit there and talk about things, but you cannot actually do what a normal parliament does, and that means laws and control the government.
Okay, Manfred, whereabouts do we find your blog online?
Well, if you Google Alles Schall und Rauch, A-L-L-E-S, Schall, S-C-H-A-L-L, and Rauch, R-A-U-C-H, which translated means more or less, it's all smoke and mirrors. If you Google that, then you will find me.
Okay, Manfred Petrich, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Justin Walker. I'm one of the campaign coordinators for the British Constitution Group and our campaigning offshoot, the New Chartist Movement. And the New Chartist Movement has created the Sovereign People's Charter. So when we call ourselves New Chartists, we take after the Sovereign People's Charter and the Great Charter of 1215, commonly known as Magna Carta.
But surely all this is out of the window, Justin, because although people voted for Brexit, it now seems that that may never happen.
Well, what's happening at the moment is we have a population that's being heavily engineered and programmed by the popular media, you know, the privately owned media that is filling with their heads with lies. I mean, the obvious lie at the moment is what we're seeing with this Extinction Rebellion, that man-made global warming is scientifically, it's a complete scam what's going on. There is geoengineering. We do know that the elite is mucking around with the weather, but the whole man-made global warming is a scam. And if you ask people like David Bellamy and people like that, and Jeremy Corbyn's brother, Piers Corbyn, who's a climatologist, they will all tell you that CO2 is a benign gas that follows temperature increases, and it's completely benign and essential to life on Earth. So it is a load of baloney what's coming out. But that's just one side where young people are being programmed in the classroom to believe that the older generation have got it wrong, and that the in fact, what we're going to be arguing now is that you've got two types of Greens. You've got, if you like, real Greens, and these are the people who, like David Bellamy, want to protect the ecosystems, want to protect diversity. We want to look after the planet, the water, you know, the seas, the oceans, and to have an economic system that does not destroy and damage the wonderful world that we have. And then you've got the, what do we call the fake Greens, which are basically run by the corporations and the elite, and who have got a particular agenda, which is Agenda 21/30, which is what the UN have, where they want to drive everyone into smart cities and to basically restore the planet back to wildness, making sure that a reduced population is living in smart cities where they can be controlled and used as the elite see fit. Now, that may sound like some sort of science fiction film from Hollywood, but in fact, this is the way that it's all starting to go. We've got George Orwell in overdrive at the moment, and you've got the rollout of 5G, which is a matrix of control. It's also extremely harmful.
Justin, a lot of people have heard about 5G. What is 5G?
It is clear that this is microwave technology, military microwave technology, that can be used to harm people, but it's also being used to give the next generation of communication and speed and God knows what else. This is how it's being sold, but I believe you have to have transmitters almost for each house or every few houses, and the fact is you're beaming this stuff in, which many people suffer ill health from. I do recognise technology which is not there to help us, but to control us.
Well, one other thing you could mention along similar lines, of course, is fracking, because we know that the chemicals which are used in fracking can permanently damage the water supply.
Oh, gosh, yes, absolutely. But fracking seems to be on the defensive. I mean, I think there is a good fight back happening at the moment. I think people are waking up. But what I am bothered about is that we do have a younger generation now who are literally being programmed to believe that the older generation, that's me, that's you, Tony, and others, we don't know what we're talking about. We've lost the plot, and that we've got to let the younger generation now rule the roost, because they've been basically programmed by the fake Greens.
Do you think we'll ever get any kind of Brexit? And what else is going on around this?
Let's face it, the European Union is the planned European The United States of Europe is designed to be a European super state at some point, and that was the creation of it. We know the French, the Danes, the Irish, they all wanted, to after the Lisbon Treaty, to try and vote to lessen the impact of what was coming, and they wanted to retain their sovereignty as much as possible, and they all had to vote again until they got it right, in inverted commas. The bureaucrats and the bankers European Central Bank, obviously, and the bankers and the bureaucrats who run the European Union. This is Orwellian, and it is sucking an awful lot of people into believing that this is a project for peace, that you'll never have world wars. Well, if you look at the First World War and the Second World War, the real history about those two wars as to how they started has yet to be told, and you will find very quickly that it's the bankers and the big corporatists had an awful lot to do with the engineering of both world wars, and that's not really being written yet, and that's something that people have got to understand, that the people who created the European Union also created the First World War and the Second World War, and virtually every war since, because war is good for business and it's good for control.
Okay, I know last time we spoke to you, you mentioned something at the sort of tail end. In this quite cheeky manner, you were saying, I'm looking into this, the Sabbatean Frankists and a chap called Jacob Franks. What have you found out about him and them? And do you think that they're a significant power in the past?
Yes, it's a hidden power, this. The Sabbatean Frankists, it's an unusual, it was a Jewish sect, but when you say Jewish, in inverted commas, because what we're discovering very quickly from real Jews, that these are fake Jews. Ashkenazi, they come from, they've got nothing to do with the bloodline of David or anything else. But
these fake religions seem to be the big thing, don't they? I mean, the Saudis talk about themselves as Muslims, even though most Muslims would say, if I was to go to Saudi Arabia, I could not just do what I normally do, otherwise I'd be arrested. We have the same sort of thing with Tony Blair being a Christian, George Bush being a Christian. A lot of people creating these kind of fake religion.
Well, in a nutshell, what Sabbatean Frankists, and it's really Jacob Franks, the one who came second, he was passionate about the belief that you could do any amount of harm and appalling things to the human race and you would get to God. In other words, they believed, their mindset was that you could actually get to God by committing appalling crimes against humanity. Abuse of children, sodomy, I mean, you name it, they were absolutely saying orgies, married people, it was just do anything, doesn't matter how bad it is, you will find the way to God as a result. And basically, this is the mindset. And they poisoned, and this is what's interesting, the three main religions that we seem to be having problems with today, and that is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. All three have been tainted. There's been poison pumped into those three religions. And this is where, so you have this, you know, strange thing that you can have Christians who are law-abiding, happy, welcoming, and get on with everyone. You have Muslims who are happy, welcoming, law-abiding, get on with everybody. And you can have Jewish people who are welcoming, happy, and law-abiding, etc., etc. And yet you also have the hatred, you have the division, and you have those who are spouting poison to try and create difficulties where humanity suffers. And, you know, in the Catholic Church, I believe that the Sabbatean Frankists were a very large driving force behind the militant Jesuits. In Islam, as far as we can make out, they were responsible for the if you like, what's going on at the moment with ISIS and all that. I mean, people say ISIS is part of the Israeli security anyway.
Well, but yeah, but you see, these are the Takfiris you're talking about here, the Wahhabists. The Salafists, which are basically a small sect, but extremely violent. And actually, many people seem to ignore the fact that these are paid mercenaries.
Yeah, exactly. So what we're trying to say is look at the Sabbatean Frankists and look at what they've created over the last 300 years. Because it's quite, I mean, they were responsible for the Illuminati on Weizsäcker. And in Frankfurt, we were just saying about Frankfurt. If you look at the Rothschilds, all started from Frankfurt. Under the Lisbon Treaty, the city of London, the financial hub, will move to Frankfurt. So Frankfurt is a hub. You've got Basel, which is a hub, Bank for International Settlements and so forth, and the city of London will still be a hub because that's not going to lose any more of its power base. So you've got this triangle of evil, and I think that's the word you have to use because effectively they're controlling the world's money, they're controlling the, you know, all aspects of the Orwellian rollout that is hitting our democracy and hitting and programming our youngsters. And we are starting to see that this is now happening. I mean, we've got, as I said, it's the turning the youngsters against the older generation and the youngsters being sucked into this belief that the world is going to be saved by this evil mindset, though, of course, they don't know it's evil. They just think it's all good at the moment.
It's interesting that, you know, divide and rule, which has been used over the centuries by the British in, you know, colonies in Africa and places like that. I mean, what you seem to be suggesting is that same technique is now being turned on the domestic population.
Absolutely, yeah. And you look at Farage, divide and rule. You look at Tommy Robinson, divide and rule. You look at, I mean, you can just seem to, everywhere you look, it's not about finding a common agreement to bring everybody together and unite against this evil. It's about dividing ourselves.
But I mean, you're definitely doing that with your charter.
This is what the whole point of the Sovereign People's Charter is, to just explain to people who our enemy is, who is our common enemy. I'm a commissioner on the ITNJ, the International Tribunal on Natural Justice, and last year we had a tribunal on child trafficking. And when you listen to some of the people who are giving evidence, you realise that these Sabbatean Frankists, the mindset, abuses millions of children. It's not just a case of some strange satanic Luciferian rituals taking place with the murder of children. We are talking about the mass trafficking of children. We are talking about the slavery of children. Everywhere you look, children are just used by pawns, by this mindset. And that, if nothing else, should wake people up to realize that we've all got to come together against this mindset.
Okay, Justin Walker, thanks very much.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests. That's Jack Windle from Bristol Acorn, talking about the Ragged Trousered Philanthropist and reading a poem by Tony Harrison. Also Manfred Petrish from the Smoke and Mirrors blog and Justin Walker from the West Country's British Constitution Group. Thanks also to studio engineers Dave Basanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk or on the phone at 909 6897. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website. do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
Let the